It's 5 o'clock and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, 90.9 on cable, and streaming online at www.cfrc.ca. We're broadcasting from the basement of Crothers Hall at Queen's University in Kingston on Turtle Island, and you're now tuned in to Radio 613. Shalom Aleichem, welcome to Radio 613, broadcasting on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston. Welcome to the show. My name is Avi, and I'm here with my co-host,
Malka. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. It's been a while since I've been on air, and I'm happy to be back. And we've got a great show for you today. On the weekend, we visited Rena Katz, the finale of Rena Katz's art installation in Kensington Market called
Each Hand, as they are called.
Thank you, Ev. So we will be featuring some sounds from the finale performance, as well as some information about the exhibition. And then in the show following that, we will be sharing a book review with our guest host, Ellie, who's in the background. I don't think you can hear her right now. But she and Evie will be talking about a book called, graphic novel called The Rabbi's Cat.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about it.
Yeah, awesome.
I love Rabbi's Cat, and we'll give you a preview of Rabbi's Cat 2, the sequel.
Ooh, exciting. So, you know, I think we'll get into the Each Hand, as they are called, stuff right now. But before we share some of the sounds from the finale performance and some of Rena Katz's words, I just thought I'd share a little bit of the backgrounder on this exhibit. So some of you may remember that we interviewed Rena Katz last year, following a controversy, as it were, with her funder, which was the Kofler Center for the Arts. So Rena has been working on she's a sound and visual artist, and she was working on an exhibit about many things. It centered in Kensington Market, so it was the exhibit is about sort of overlapping histories and layered memories related to her own family's immigration experience in Kensington Market, her own queer history in Kensington Market, as well as Jewish history in Kensington Market and labor history in Kensington Market. She'd been working on the project for about 11 months with funding from the Jewish Arts Center, the Kofler Center for the Arts. And, you know, approximately like a week or two before she was set, one week before the exhibit was set to begin, the Kofler Center for the Arts publicly disassociated themselves with the artist because of her past involvement in Palestinian solidarity political activities. The project itself was not related to the occupation or Israel or Palestine in any way. I mean, I think that it was the plans for the project, and the project as it turned out has some really interesting political aspects to it, but it really had nothing to do with Israel. But Kofler Center for the Arts still disassociated themselves with her, and it really put a huge hamper on the plans for the art project that had been underway for 11 months. She had had an association with Baycrest Terrace, an elders residence in Kensington?
Up in North Toronto.
Okay, in North Toronto, but where a number of people who had lived in Kensington Market were now living, and she was doing an exploration of the game of Mahjong with folks from the Baycrest Terrace. And, you know, following the Koffler Center's disassociation, Baycrest Terrace also disassociated themselves with her. And so that whole aspect of her project, which, you know, from speaking with Rena Katz, was something that she held very close to her heart. It was an aspect of the project that was related to her experiences with her grandparents as a child. And so that aspect of the project was ended. And, you know, so the project, even though she didn't lose funding, there was all sorts of bad sort of public relations that followed the disassociation, a lot of animosity and hostility within sort of that came up within the Jewish arts community, and it affected the project in a big way. Nevertheless, the Each Hand, as they are called, project did persevere, and it ran, do you remember the dates of the...
It began at the start of October.
Okay.
What's the date?
Yeah. It ran for at least a few weeks and consisted of a series of performances in Kensington Market, as well as a series of a poster series related to the themes that I mentioned earlier, but also, you know, mildly incorporating some of the experience with the Koffler Center. And yeah, and the finale was on Sunday evening. So that's just a little overview. We've got some excerpts from the finale.
Yeah. As Malka said, we were really happily able to make it in for the finale, and mostly this part of the exhibit consisting of performances of Rena Katz's interpretation of songs by the Yiddish pop duet, the Barry Sisters, sung by local Toronto singers. And also you'll hear some explanation of some of the posters that are around town, and I think a little bit of talk about the scaffolding exhibit, which did end up happening. It was actually during the Sukkot period earlier in the month as part of the exhibit as well. So we met in Kensington at the appropriate time, 8:42 p.m., which was the start of the exhibit, and 183 Augusta, a sort of random storefront, and we weren't really sure what to expect. We met Rena Katz along the way, so you'll hear some discussion with her, which was really great. As we were waiting on the street, this accordion player with sort of a painted mask on his face was walking down the street, and sort of wondering if that was sort of klezmery sounds, if that was part of the exhibit. It turns out it was just a passerby, and then these two singers sort of showed up, and then you'll hear them walking from spot to spot throughout Kensington again, and you'll hear some explanations of why particular spots were chosen. So here it is, some sounds from Each Hand, as they are called, here on Radio 613.
But I also wanted to show you a couple of the posters.
Yeah, that would be great.
Because they're more like in this strip, you can see some really good examples of them. There's three. There's a series of three. They all look like this. This is one. This is actually number three. They're sort of all over the market. They're printed. They're hand printed on letterpress by our designer Leslie Topness. And these are old 78 record sleeves. And each of them has an index from a different section of a book by Sarah Ahmed called Queer Phenomenology. So this one is on space. And these are actually images of the Barry Sisters, which are the sister duo that this music is based on. And then they all have this. And these words, which you can see better on the other images, which are layerings of different words that sort of emerged during the fiasco. And this group of text is about tables.
Okay.
So we used tables, lines, and spaces as kind of the symbols for what we were trying to explore. And just to be frank, it was actually reading through this index, which we've converted into Morse code, that kind of gave me solace the afternoon that I was dissociated from. It was around a table that the four of us sat when Mona and Lori told us that they'd be dissociating based on my public political actions. And I felt that as Jewish women, we needed to really reconsider that symbol and share that table instead of make it into like a table of barriers and boundaries. So I wanted to use this index in the posters. And
is that also the index from the book?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we used just her section on lines, spaces, and tables.
Okay.
Why did you convert it to Morse code?
Because there's a lot that I didn't feel I could say. Right, with this project, because of what happened. So we worked with coding on a number of levels, and that was one of them. And then this one has some scaffolding to kind of gesture to the scaffolding piece, and that's the lines index, and you can see it's really layered and covering over itself and kind of repeating itself. And then these are words that have been layered on top of each other as another form of coding.
Those are also words from the fiasco.
Yeah.
Can you read some of those for us?
See, I'm nervous to even do it because I know it'll be on air, but you could probably decipher some of them. Or maybe not.
Is that the A word? Or is there Morse
you
code?
You tell me, I don't know.
So is there Morse for a part? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of... maybe down the road we can talk about the words. I did a performance in the scaffolding that involved Mahjong tiles, and I also did a group community workshop in teaching Jewish Mahjong inside the scaffolding. So we had it in two different ways.
Cool.
But the project with the seniors where they were going to teach the youth how to do it, that was rendered destroyed by the Koffler's decision. So, yeah, it wasn't possible.
Shabbat Shalom.
Axe and Son Meat Market.
Yeah, they finally moved in, eh?
The new place?
See, this place is interesting because when we were going to do the original project, he was selling.
Oh, really?
No, he was selling, but he didn't have the sign up yet. Then as soon as all the shit hit the fan, we saw a sign go up in the window. And it was just like this amazing symbol for what had happened to the project because he's one of the only remaining Jewish businesses. Like, his dad opened this in 1952. So he retired. His name's Solly. His dad's name was Max. So Solly retired and he just sold it to this like organic meat guy, which is so sort of indicative of what's happening in the market, right? And sure. It's actually like a really kind of beautiful pass off because people want to buy local organic meat, right? Mm-hmm. And he's keeping the signs and he's got images in the window of like the original place. So mm-hmm. It's just a really beautiful symbol that the timing was totally in unison with what happened with our project because he actually is opening on Thursday,
right?
The new store. Huh. So it's really interesting to me that way, but we should go this way now. There were a number of Yiddish-speaking sister duos that sang Yiddish folk music in a kind of vamped-up big band style. It became known as Yiddish swing. And the Barry sisters were one of the most famous duos who did this. They were originally known as the Bagelman sisters. And then they kind of gained some bigger sort of fame, basically, around North America. And essentially, their voices are incredibly haunting, and they sing in harmony, and very interesting and often absurd and bizarre compositions, right? That are these mix of traditional klezmer, swing, and like something else entirely. So I've always been really drawn to that music. And I like to take these sort of long, extended vocalizations on a single note and then invert them with digital processing and sort of play with the elasticity of it. And also the language itself, kind of inverting the Yiddish, because as a language, it's the way it was spoken at that time is almost non-existent now, right? So the main Jewish community that still speaks it is the Lubavitch community, which has a very different kind of political sensibility. So that's where the context of those pieces are coming from. And for me, it's really a symbol of the way I experience memory in the market. Because my family did migrate to this place when they came to Canada, I often feel these little haunting moments that are very fleeting and kind of sad, right? So that was sort of the idea with those compositions. And they were in the original project.
Right. And they're partly your own, from your own compositions, inspired by the...
Well, how I compose them was to take Barry Sisters' music, invert it, cut it up, play with it, and then transliterate what the Yiddish sounded like. There's one word that's four words, which is Bemala, which means little tree, in the first composition that they sang tonight. So, for the most part, hey, how's it going?
Hey.
Or a yuppie bakery.
Or a yuppie bakery. Where are we? Which street?
Kensington Street in the Maui. I haven't been to Global Cheese.
That one there. Mm-hmm. The big one in the corner before the big building. That's the one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
spots where they stopped, were they spots of
They were definitely, there's 13 locations that we covered over six performances, and they have four origins. One is my family's migration history here. One is the labor history of the market, mostly Jewish labor history of the market. One is my sort of queer coming out locations of exes. And one is like Jewish spiritual sites. So we did both synagogues. The Bright Pearl restaurant used to be the Labor Lyceum. Emma Goldman's body lay in that building when she died. We did her apartment. We did like this Parts Unknown alley that they were behind the fence on. That was a job I had when I was about 20. I used to work in a worm composting shack at the end of that alley.
Right.
Things like that. Where we started is my ex's apartment. Where they got assaulted is another ex's apartment. So it's this mix, right, that sort of defines memory for me in a lot of ways. That's like non-linear, essentially. The way that memory is a linear sort of thing when it's embodied in that way. So over a month, we kind of covered all of the 13 locations, and then I put in.
Okay, so that was sounds from the Each Hand Is There called exhibit in Kensington Market, put on by the artist Rena Katz and curated by Kim Simon. Keep tuning in. We're going to talk a little bit more about that Jewish labor history of Kensington that Rena was speaking about. But first, we're going to hear some music from the Barry Sisters. This is...
Wie ist das Gesella? Where is the village?
Okay.
Rein in du Stiebel in bin bald a Reus. Bin mir in mein Jingel is alles schön aus. La da da la da da. Of my youth, where is the boy who kissed me with the truth? Where are the young hearts that sang unafraid? Where are the visions and where have they strayed? Where are the young hearts that sang unafraid? Where are the visions and where have they strayed?
So that was Wie ist das Gesellschaft by the Barry Sisters, Where is the Village, and an appropriately nostalgic song following the bits and pieces from Rena Katz's exhibit, you know, which focused so much on memory. Another interesting quick note about that song, well, I was visiting my parents and with my brother and sister in Ottawa a few weeks ago, and my brother was playing all these Yiddish song YouTube videos that he had found and been listening to, and he played this song, and my sister recognized it as a Francophone kind of folk song that she had known as a child, and then described to me how once she sang it to a Danish friend of hers who said, oh, that's a Danish song too. So I don't know the answer, but I'm curious to know sort of where the song originates linguistically. Anyway, side note. So it was really great to visit Rena Katz in Toronto and have her walk us through, you know, the performance and some of the posters and other aspects of her project. One of the historical focuses of the project was the Jewish labor history of Kensington Market. So that labor history focuses on, it took place mainly in the Depression era between the two world wars. It's a very interesting time in Canadian Jewish history. I mean, the Toronto and Montreal were probably the main centers of Jewish population in Canada. In 1931, there was over 45,000 Jews in Toronto, and there was a huge working class Jewish population located in Kensington Market, which was not the part of town where the Jews first landed, but the part of town where they, you know, rapidly moved, and it was a big Jewish market at the time, and sort of, you know, reminiscent of like the Lower East Side in New York, or even of European ghettos or shtetls of the immigrants' homelands, as it were. And so the Jewish population was, you know, was working in factories and sweatshops. Huge industry was the textile industry. And in 1941, sort of nearing, you know, I guess around nearing the end of the explosive labor history, 90% of Jewish women in Toronto were working in the textile industry. Mostly in unskilled jobs, unlike their male counterparts. And, you know, one thing that I found interesting about Rena's exhibit and about the difficulty that she faced with the Kaufler Center for the Arts is that some of the labor history she sort of talks about, some of the labor history the Jewish labor history of the area, includes history of these really strong women. You know, unlike the sort of non-Jewish women of the time, the sort of Jewish femininity of that class segment included a sort of aggressive protest that was like part of what it was to be a Jewish working class woman. And that protest happened, you know, within the garment workers' unions, as well as sort of more in the home arena. There was like a bread protest in the 20s, I think. And so I just sort of felt like that was kind of connected to Rena became like politicized by the Kaufler Center's disassociation with her, and that in a way, you know, like pushed her to be to take a stance of protest, which I think mirrors some of the atmosphere, some of the sort of personality and, yeah, the personality of women in the Jewish labor history that she's talking about in Kensington Market. Yeah, I mean, it was a great exhibit. I was commenting to some friends after seeing it that it's tough. I mean, it's like it's a tough type of art, you know, that's kind of pretty ethereal. And I think had I been walking down the street like other people were and just heard the music and seen the singers, I would have had no idea. I wouldn't have known what it was, but I was really glad that we had the opportunity to chat with Rena and have her explain the sort of overlapping ideas and how she sort of chose this non-linear mode because that's the mode of memory. And I think that, you know, maybe I have a personal tendency to want to understand things really intellectually, and I'm glad that I had the opportunity a little bit to do so, but at the same time, maybe the art would have evoked a sort of non-linear reaction that doesn't, you know, work so well with the intellect. Anyway.
Yeah, I also really connected with it a lot, and I think that idea of using non-linear memory, I think, articulated a lot about how I feel in a also sort of fleeting way to my own family's Jewish history of labor struggle, and also how I feel connected to it, you know, just personally based on my own politics, Jewish ethics, etc. It's not this really concrete line between me and those really strong movements in the 20s and 30s, but at the same time, I have these waves of feeling extraordinarily connected to it on just an emotional level or an intellectual level, but it kind of comes in and goes as far as that connection. So, yeah. And, you know, in light of your really great discussion about women's labor in Toronto, we're going to play a song. This is a current version of Arbeiter Frauen, Worker Woman by Adrian Cooper.
Arbeiter Frauen, leidende Frauen, Frauen, wo schmachten in Haus und Fabrik? Wo steht ihr von Weidens? Was helft ihr nicht bäuen, dem Tempel von Freiheit, von menschlichem Glück? Helft uns tragen dem Banner, dem Reuten, vorwärts durch Sturm, durch finstere Nacht. Helft uns Freiheit und Licht zu verspreiten, zwischen umwissende Eltern. Die heiligen Namen, Perovskaya, Helfmann, Ginsburg und noch. Mit tausende Freuen, was pflegen sich schämen, zu tragen gehorsam dem Sklaven der Joch. Helft uns die Welt von ihr Schmutz zu erheben, alles opfern, was uns ist lieb, mit dem Kämpfen zusammen wie mächtige Leben. Für Freiheit, für Gleichheit, für unser Prinzip.
Welcome back to Radio 613, broadcasting on CFRC 101.9 FM and podcasting at radio613.wordpress.com, and you can get all of our old shows there, as well as some editions of the Radio 613 Collective's music show, Semitic Soul, and you can check out our interview with Rena Katz from May as well, if you want to sort of catch up on how that went down at the time. So we're moving on to what maybe will be a new segment of Radio 613, a book review segment, comic book to be specific.
So graphic novel.
I'm happy with comic book.
Okay. We'll talk about that later.
We've got Ellie here in studio, so welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. So we are going to be talking about The Rabbi's Cat. Sort of, it's, I guess, part one, because they were originally released, these stories, individually. And they were kind of the edition that I have read and going to review is a collection of the first three stories. And so this is a graphic novel, and the author is Johan Sofar, and it was originally published in French. Of course, I read it in English because I don't speak French. And it's the first story. Kind of introduces the theme of the stories. So it's about a rabbi, his daughter, and their cat. And most of the characters in the story are unnamed and just referred to as the cat, the rabbi, which is, I think, interesting storytelling. I like that. And so the first story, the Bar Mitzvah, is the title. And it's kind of an introduction to the characters, and it's the cat, who is, lives happily with the rabbi and his daughter.
Where are they living?
Oh, right, in Algeria.
Is it mentioned the town in Algeria? I'm not sure.
It actually, I didn't see that it mentioned in the first book, but right. I know from being the second book, it's Algiers.
Okay.
I don't know why they didn't mention it.
In the 30s, yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, and it's in the 1930s. Thank you, Avi.
You're welcome.
And so what happens in this book is the cat eats a really annoying parakeet, and as a result can talk, and so there's sort of an adventure that comes out of that. I don't want to give away too much, but one of the interesting things is that the cat has a sort of pretty strong affection for the rabbi's daughter, and because he is speaking, the first thing he does is lie when he speaks, and so the rabbi is not excited about this and doesn't want the cat to sort of spend time with his daughter and, as he said, put bad ideas into her head. And so because of that, he's not allowed to spend time with the rabbi's daughter. Did I just say that? I forgot. And so we're gonna kind of read a little bit from this chapter, and that's kind of like foreground for what we're going to read to you. So the part we're starting at,
pretty much what you just described. So the cat is no longer able to hang out with Zelabia. The cat refers to the rabbi's daughter as his mistress, and so the cat's sort of starting a exclusive relationship with the rabbi. Does that make sense, would you say?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's beautiful drawings. I really like it. And so, we'll just start reading with them studying Torah together with a pot of tea beside them. He wants me to study the Torah and the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Gemara. He wants to put me back on the straight and narrow. Do you want to explain the grimace? The cat's grimace.
The cat's grimacing, right. The cat is not pleased with this sort of obligation.
He tells me that I have to be a good Jew and that a good Jew does not lie. I answer that I'm only a cat. I add that I don't know if I'm a Jewish cat or not.
The cat looks really sort of sarcastic in that moment.
Okay, so we've got the next frame here. It's actually a really nice drawing in the rabbi's study. The menorah burning. The rabbi tells me that of course I'm Jewish since my masters are Jews. I tell him that I'm not circumcised.
It's difficult to describe the way the cat looks, but it's pretty fitting to what you think he would look like when he's thinking that.
And sitting on, I think maybe the Gemara. He tells me that they don't circumcise cats. I tell him that I haven't even had a bar mitzvah. He tells me that the bar mitzvah occurs at 13 years of age, so I tell him that I am 7 years old, and for cats, the years are multiplied by 7. Therefore, it's as if I were 7 times 7 years old, which is definitely more than 13.
So at that point, the cat is sitting on the rabbi's desk, and they have their faces pretty close to each other, and it's kind of comedic the way they're talking.
I tell him that if I'm a Jewish cat, I want to be bar mitzvahed. So, the next scene, which I like a lot, so maybe we can keep going. They're off in the streets of Algiers.
Yeah.
And I will continue to play the cat, and maybe you can do the other vocals once they come in.
Okay.
So they're walking through the streets here. We go to the rabbi's rabbi to ask him if a cat that talks can be bar mitzvahed. So
no, bar mitzvahs are not for cats. They're the rabbi's rabbi.
I ask him what the difference is between a human and a cat.
He replies, Hashem made man in his own image.
I ask him to show me a picture of God.
He tells me that God is a word.
Turning page.
It's an interesting process trying to read a graphic novel.
Yeah. So we now see a picture of a shisha at the feet of the rabbi's rabbi, who's wearing slippers. I say to the rabbi's rabbi that if man resembles God because he knows how to talk, then I resemble man.
He says no, because my speech is evil, because I acquired it in an act of killing.
I tell him that isn't true, that I didn't eat the parrot.
He says that even worse, I am a liar.
I say, and very defiantly here, with the coals of the shisha fuming, I say that with speech you can say what you want, even things that aren't true, that it's an amazing power, that he should try it.
The rabbi's rabbi tells the rabbi that he doesn't want to see me anymore and that I should be drowned.
The rabbi tells his rabbi that he won't drown me because he loves me and I don't like water. And I tell the rabbi's rabbi that I am God, that I am God who has taken the appearance of a cat in order to test him. I tell him, and now he's jumping right on the rabbi's rabbi, I tell him that I am not at all satisfied with his behavior. And he's scratching his nose. I tell him that he was as dogmatic and obtuse with me as some Christians are with Jews. And he gets on his knees and begs my forgiveness.
The image of that kind of describes that very, very well. I don't know how else to say that.
The cat looks very pleased with himself at this point. Yeah. I tell him that it was a joke, that I'm only a cat, and that he can get up.
The rabbi's rabbi says that I blasphemy, and that I lie, and that I usurp the name of God, and that I should be drowned.
The rabbi asks him if a rabbi shouldn't systematically accept contradiction from his students, if that isn't the very basis of Talmudic teaching.
Contradiction, yes. Malice and malevolence, no, replies the rabbi's rabbi. Students should bite their master like the way puppies do.
In Jewish tradition, the dog is a good animal, says the rabbi's rabbi, mm-hmm. because it is honest, persistent, and prepared to suffer for the common good. As for cats, you can't trust a cat. And so we see the cat now thinking to himself, blah, blah, blah. Nonsense. A dog's a sunny, simple-minded, moralistic, macho shithead. I asked the rabbi's rabbi where in the Bible he found this praise of dogs. He doesn't know. And the cat's thinking mischievously to himself, I'm nocturnal, unpredictable, and deeply ethical.
He answers by talking about the oral Torah that wasn't fully written down.
And you see the rabbi's rabbi pontificating in silhouette. So, do you want to
continue? He speaks the spirit of the law rather than the letter. He speaks of the spirit of the law rather than the letter.
And then he tells me that the Greeks believe the dog to be the epitome of the philosophical animal, the dog, not the cat. I reply that the Greeks destroyed the Temple of Jerusalem, and if a rabbi ends up calling on them for help, it means he's run out of arguments.
He tells me that the Torah speaks more of humans than of dogs or cats, and that the question I've raised is pointless.
I tell him that's enough, that I want to be a bar mitzvah. I tell him that I want to convert to Judaism. He asks me why. I tell him that if I'm a good Jew, the rabbi will let me spend time with his daughter. I explain to him that the rabbi's daughter is my mistress, that I can't live without her because she is my joy and love is a beautiful thing.
He tells me that my motives for converting to Judaism are unsatisfactory, that my love of God isn't sincere.
I never said anything about love of God.
And that scene kind of ends with a shot of the city of Algiers, and it's a really nice scene.
So we have this discussion sort of continuing on, but hopefully you get an idea of some of the dialogue. But basically, the book brings up some actually really great issues around what is Jewish, what is not Jewish, in really interesting and funny way. So there's some talk about, you know, how once the cat starts studying, and the cat wants to start studying Kabbalah right away, and the rabbi's not so sure. And these are sort of like, and I guess as the story goes along, there's also some tension between the colonial French occupation and them sending like a French rabbi to take the place of the rabbi in Algeria.
And before that, even there's an interesting part in sort of this imposition of like the colonial language of French onto this rabbi specifically, mm-hmm. and sort of that being a new process that literacy in French is something that's valued and sort of mandated.
Mm-hmm. And you know, there's also some discussion, or part of the story talks about the dynamics between sort of Ashkenaz supremacy of sorts being imposed on the Sephardic and Mizrahi indigenous Jewish communities, which is also really interesting. You know, the family ends up going to France, and there's some interplay there, and some interesting talk about secular Jewish practice and religious Jewish practice, and you know, the rabbi's cat. Good book.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have more thoughts. I mean, on it. We've got a few more minutes here.
Yeah, I think what I really enjoy about this is how clever and humorous these sort of ideas are looked at and discussed. And I also think, like, the author knows cats. He like understands cats, and I think it was perfect the way he sort of projected this skeptic, secular character onto the cat, because I think it just goes really well with the nature of cats. Like, and it's pretty obvious that he loves cats. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. So you're on to The Rabbi's Cat 2. Maybe we'll do a book review of Rabbi's Cat 2. And I'm hoping to have Johann Svar on the show. I think we should contact him, and that would be great.
There's also a movie, The Rabbi's Cat, in production.
The Klezmer series, which you're also reading, which I'm excited to read, also by Johann Svar. So you can check out all those books. I encourage you to do so. They're hilarious and fun to read.
Definitely.
So we're coming to the end of the show. Malka, you're still in studio with us. Welcome back.
Oh, there's the red light. Yeah, thank you for that expose. I have not read The Rabbi's Cat. But you made me think about a cat that I once got. So I was living in Montreal at the time, and I went to the Humane Society shortly after, right in the beginning of the new year, like in January. And my partner and I picked out an old cat, and the person at the SPCA that was helping us out was like, oh, you know, nice grandpa, what a great Christmas gift. And so I said to her, oh, well, you know, it's not going to be a Christian cat. So she answered, oh, okay, so it's Hanukkah Harry, which is obviously like a horrific name for a cat. So we ended up lovingly calling him Zeta. But, you know, I don't think I would normally think animals could have religions. But, you know, maybe I need to read the book.
It's interesting, actually, because just to add to that, I once heard about someone feeding Zeta some treif, and I was kind of upset, and Malka responded to me, cats aren't religious. And I was like, well, I don't know. And I feel like The Rabbi's Cat was a good expansion of that idea for me.
We need to scour the Gemara, maybe. I'm sure there's many tractates about feline conversion.
Yeah, I mean, there are like halachic laws in terms of how we handle animals, mm-hmm. right? I mean, especially on Shabbos, all sorts of stuff. So
for sure,
doesn't necessarily
relate to the animals itself's religiosity, but certainly interaction with animals is a
religiously bound certainly issue. A lot of ethical guidelines around treatment of animals, including ones that would be sort of considered domesticated.
Right.
So, yeah, and my favorite part maybe of the book is how the cat in Rabbi's Cat reveals to the rabbi that there actually he does know of parts of the Torah that speak highly of dogs, but was sort of keeping it to himself. You know, that debate sort of continues, and some verses about cats maybe are brought up, and the cat sort of conceals the verses about dogs.
To verses that sort of look at cats as valuable, and so that's, and he had kept that to himself because he didn't want to challenge his rabbi.
Right, right. I love, that's great.
I mean, it sounded to me, and again, I haven't read the book, but it sounded like from the short reading that you did, that maybe the cat is maybe on one level, the cat's a cat, but on the other level, the cat's a metaphor for a different type of being, right? So, I mean, I thought it was interesting that he was 7 years old and that every year for a cat is worth 7 years. So he was 7 by 7, which is 49, which is also the number of days of the counting of the Omer, right? And so, like, the number of, and there's all sorts of interpretations of all those days, right? So,
Radio 613, going past the pshat level of comic books. That should be our new slogan. So yeah, we're coming to the close of the show. Thanks a lot, Ellie, for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And please tune in next week, Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Shavua Tov.